This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to your weekly podcast into England's past. I'm Charles Rowe. You can join us with new episodes every Thursday, so make sure you subscribe to get regular updates. Now this week we're marking 300 years since one of the most infamous stock market crashes in English history. It was a bubble fueled by wild speculation and driven by dubious morals, and a bubble which ruined the fortunes of many investors, including some whose estates are now cared for by English Heritage. Joining me this week to discuss the South Sea Company stock market bubble and crash are English Heritage's historians team leader, Dr. Andrew Han, and Dr. Helen Paul, who is a lecturer in economics and economic history at the University of Southampton. Welcome to you both. Dr. Paul, I'd like to start with you first. Let's go back three centuries to August 1720, when investment in shares in the South Sea Company peaked. Can you explain what the South Sea Company was and why it was created?
Yes, the British government had run up a lot of debts in war, and they particularly needed to keep paying their Navy contractors. And they just ran out of ways to do that. So they offered the contractors shares in a new company, the South Sea Company, and told them that this company was going to be doing two things. It was going to trade in slaves and goods to colonies in Spanish America. That's the colonies that the Spanish Empire had. But it was also going to do work for the government. It was going to deal with government debt. And that's the side of the company I think is quite difficult to explain.
Yeah, try me.
Well, what happens is you've got people who hold on to government IOUs of some sort. And a lot of the time, there's a lot of red tape costs in dealing with all these different people. The government doesn't keep the payments up to date. It's difficult for someone who holds one of these IOUs to give it to someone else to put it in their name. So the idea was there would be an efficiency gain if holders of government debt could be persuaded to swap them for company shares. Then you get the share that's easily traded, and you also get maybe some dividends from the company. And the company is paid a fee, what was supposed to be government debt servicing, because it's now holding on to all the government IOUs. That is actually the way the Bank of England was set up. And that's why it's a bit convoluted. So you can imagine the government takes cash from someone, gives them an IOU. The IOU then goes into this company, be it the Bank of England or the South Sea. And then the government pays the company a flat fee, and the company pays dividends to the shareholders. And this is where the accusations of fraud tend to come from, because people don't quite understand why anyone would do this. But actually, if you were holding an IOU that wasn't getting any government payments, government was going behind with its payments, and you couldn't sell it to anyone else easily, you might think a share was a better deal.
Mm. Yeah, it sounds really pretty convoluted and slightly dodgy to start with. But what did it supposedly offer to investors, and why were people so attracted to this?
Well, they get a liquidity gain. In other words, they have a financial instrument that they can sell if they need cash, which some of these older government IOUs, there just wasn't the legal structure to allow them to easily transfer it. So if I'm selling one of these things to you, how am I going to put it into your name so that it's now yours and you pay me cash for that? Whereas with a share, that's much more easily transferred. So there is this liquidity premium argument. There's also the fact that if you've got lots of different government debts held by different groups of people scattered about, there's no real pressure on the government to keep paying any of this. While as a big intermediary can demand the fee gets paid. I mean, the whole thing became much more rationalized and actually moved from short-term high interest debts that the government was stuck with to a much longer, lower interest payment, longer-term lower interest payments. So although it might sound dodgy to you, it is actually fairly straightforward when you understand a bit of the finance.
Yeah.
And it's not as weird as it sounds.
I don't know if we're going down too much of a rabbit hole with this question, but normally investors buy government bonds, don't they, or gilts, is that right, in sort of times of crisis? But in this case, it sounds as though
instead of buying direct government debt, you're sort of creating a company as an intermediary and then trading shares in that instead. Is that a fair summary?
That's true, but government gilts, as you're calling them, are really about a later British government bond that is reliable. We're talking about government debts that aren't very reliable because the government's running out of cash. This is the modern government bonds, the gilts for a developed country like Britain, are fairly low risk or no risk, essentially. But at this period, the government could go bust. I mean, it could just stop paying. And a lot of the time, you're holding government debt that wasn't being serviced. So they weren't keeping their side of the bargain. That's why you needed the intermediary. Plus, the intermediary was given some sort of monopoly right that was valuable, and that was the incentive to change over.
Okay, let's talk about that intermediary then, which is obviously the South Sea Company. What was its connection to slavery? You touched on it briefly.
The South Sea Company had the right, firstly issued by the British government and then ratified by the Spanish Crown, to be the sole provider of African enslaved people to ports in Spanish control in the Americas. And that meant you had a foothold in those markets. You could bring in some goods as well. And the Spanish colonies needed a steady supply of new labour. And what they were doing was bringing enslaved people from Africa. The South Sea Company worked together with the Royal African Company, which was a more established company, but also got support from the Royal Navy in order to carry out this trade.
Okay. And obviously, with the benefit of hindsight and obviously 21st century experience, especially in light of recent events, the way that we look at this now is obviously with horror. But how big was share trading at this time, and who was investing in South Sea Company?
Share trading at this time period is quite sophisticated. You have derivatives trading, for example, but it's not very formalised. There's not a lot in the terms of legislation or regulation. A lot of people, especially the upper ranks in society, might own shares, but it wasn't as embedded in the system as it is today, obviously, where you have pension funds investing in shares and bonds and other things. But it grew out of earlier practices of trading in various sorts of financial instruments, so people were quite familiar with it in many ways.
And this is obviously the upper classes, I presume, who are investing in this company and others in the stock market.
Not just them, not just the upper classes. It went quite far down the scale. You found people you could invest if you were a servant. One of the things that was clear is that it was very much open to everybody. If you had the money, you could just walk in to where shares were being traded, like in coffee houses. There wasn't a lot of barriers to entry at all. And it grew out of, say, other investments in lottery tickets. That was a popular one, which attracted a very wide range of investors, including servants, women. There isn't a middle class at this time, but the idea of the merchant group or craftsmen. So it tends to be that the very wealthy, it's their records that survive. So that's how we can trace them. But we know through looking at various ledgers that quite a lot of people were not from a very aristocratic background at all.
Right. That's really interesting, that sense of it being democratised in this sort of early stage of the markets. You talked about walking into a coffee shop. How would you trade shares?
Well, you could go to where there was a broker if you wanted, or you could buy directly from the company. There were various ways of doing that, and people had intermediaries. They got their friends to buy for them, or they could get a professional broker, as I say. And you just have to then register the trade with the company, so it's in the books. And that's fairly easy to do.
And I suppose the fact that this whole system of buying and selling was quite democratised at this point meant that it did attract lots of people with lots of money, but also people with not a lot of money, but it would have been a lot of money to them had they invested in the South Sea Company. So what were the sort of conditions that led up to this bubble? I'm presuming a lot of people from all different backgrounds piling in.
Well, yes, and certainly as well, one of the big issues is the Mississippi bubble. That is that the French economy was completely overhauled by someone called John Law, and there was a huge boom in shares on the French stock market. Then people removed their money when they realised that things were going wrong and sent some to London. So that helped to push up share prices in London. Also, you've got the end of one big war and another big war is coming to an end. That's the War of the Spanish Succession and the Great Northern War. That again means that people are more likely to pull out their money from under the bed and want to put it somewhere. And there was just this lack of alternative investments that were quite as liquid. There was the possibility of making big profits, especially early on. People got the impression that they could make a guaranteed return. And you get newcomers coming into the market are over enthusiastic as well. And that pushes up the bubble in the short term.
Yes, and a fool and his money are soon parted, as the saying goes. When did it all come unravelling then? When did it all crash?
Well, it comes about the autumn and early winter, really. This is when you start seeing people wanting to deal with the debts from the agricultural year. It's around the time when the court is moving back to Hanover. The various things where you start to get a reckoning where people start wanting the cash and want to sell out. But I think people who knew what they were doing realized the shares were completely overvalued. And when they start selling, then you get panic conditions, you get a huge crash, and then a rebound in the price. So if you were one of the people who bought at the top of the market and then panics and sold out, you could make a big loss. But if you had been quite sanguine and held onto your shares, the share price does bounce back again.
Okay. Let's take the scenario that the market has crashed and people have lost a lot. What did happen to those people who had invested in the South Sea Company? Sometimes we hear stories even today of people taking their own lives, their marriages fall apart, this sort of thing. Can you give us a few anecdotes or stories from that time?
A lot of the anecdotes are actually myths. So we start to see that image of the falling stockbroker falling out of a window. You can see images like that, which become a motif throughout every big crash. You have those stories around the Wall Street crash of the stockbroker falling from a height.
Of 1929.
1929, yeah. So you can see images like that. There's a lot of outpouring of art and cultural responses to this. But actually, it's not that big a crash in terms of the effects on the real economy, in terms of the effects on people concerned. There's much more talk about it, and people might have lost a little bit of money. That was more common than losing a vast amount of money. A lot of the richer people, their money would be tied up in various things anyway, like trust funds and the like, and so they couldn't necessarily lose a grand estate. Plus, a lot of people are complaining about a projected gain that just doesn't occur. So I was going to put another wing on my house and I can't because I didn't make all this money.
Do you think it hurts the upper classes less than it would have done the sort of regular merchants, the lower middle classes?
It's very difficult to say because the South Sea Company's own books, many of them were thrown out about 100 years later. We don't have very much to tell us who invested in what. And we can really see more wealthy people keep records for a longer period of time and they end up in archives and then we can see who does what. But I suppose a lot of wealthy people would have had a well-diversified portfolio. They would have had their housing, land, maybe a business, all kinds of properties. And so they might have complained a lot, but there aren't many cases at all of anybody really coming a cropper. And some of the things that are said about the crash are said in very vague terms. We can't really tell how many people were truly ruined by it. Probably not that many.
I'd like to bring in Dr. Andrew Han at this point. You can explain a bit more about who was affected in the upper classes and the aristocracy. I understand former owners of some of the great estates now in English Heritage's care were some of those affected. Can you tell us who they were and what the repercussions were?
Well, we know that a couple of the owners of English Heritage sites were impacted by the crash, particularly the owners of Rest Park, that's Henry Duke of Kent, and the owner of Brodsworth Hall, that's George Hay, Viscount Duplin at this time.
Right. Tell us more about the situation with Rest Park. How was that affected?
Well, we know that Henry Duke of Kent lost considerable amounts of money in the bubble when it burst, and this really meant that he wasn't able to rebuild his house that he'd been planning to do. I mean, the background to this is that Henry had commissioned some designs for a new house from the Venetian architect Giacomo Leone in about 1713 to 16. He was very dissatisfied with his existing house, which was a real mishmash of styles. There was the old house, which had bits of it were medieval, some of it was Tudor, and it had a sort of classical north front, which had been added in the 1670s, but it wasn't really a sort of unified house. And so he commissioned two different designs from Leone. And then he had had these sent out to his son, Anthony, Earl of Harold, who was on a grand tour of Italy at the time in 1715. And the idea was that Anthony would show these to leading Italian architects of the time. And he ended up showing them to a Sicilian architect, Filippo Givara, and also, incidentally, to the King of Savoy. And both of them had critiques of these designs and suggested alternative plans. But what ended up happening was that because of the losses in the South Sea bubble, although he had these all these different designs for a potential new house, no house was actually built. And it's been surmised in the past that this was partly due to his losses in the South Sea bubble, but also to the fact that he lost his two sons, both the Earl of Harold, who died in 1723, and his other son, who died in 1717. And so he had no male heir at this point. And also his London townhouse just happened to burn down around the same time and had to be rebuilt. So there was lots of sort of catastrophes happening to the Duke, which meant that he didn't end up rebuilding. But it's certainly thought that the losses he made in the South Sea bubble were significant. And interestingly, later in his time at rest, first of all, he switched his attention to the gardens and started doing more work there than he did in the house. But it's been suggested by others that he was being rather parsimonious with this work. For instance, he brought in the designer Batty Langley to do the commission for the remodelling of the bowling greenhouse and building of a new greenhouse in the 1730s. But it's been suggested he only did this because Langley was fairly cheap compared with some of the alternative architects he could have brought in. And this is sort of showing certainly a reduced means that the Duke had at this point. And when he did come to make changes to his house in the 1730s, rather than completely rebuilding it, he just added a new dining room in 1735, which is again done by Batty Langley. So a lot more minor than he was going to before. And the conclusive proof comes when the Duke of Kent died in 1740, because his successor, Jemima Marchioness Grey, and her husband, Philip York, found the estate encumbered with debts of £12,570, and they had to sell off some estates in Herefordshire, some Herefordshire properties, in order to be able to take up residence at rest, which they didn't do till 1743. So you can see clearly that the Duke, who was immensely wealthy at the beginning of his time at rest, after 1720, after the crash, he's in much reduced means.
That's some legacy, isn't it, to leave the next generation saddled with debt?
Yeah, it's very much so. I mean, and in a sense, the predicament that befell George Hay at Brodsworth Hall is even more instructive. I mean, he had been an up-and-coming politician. He'd been taken under the wings of Robert Harley, the Earl of Oxford, when he'd married Harley's daughter in 1709. And then he'd become an MP, and he'd entered the House of Lords as Baron Hay of Pedwardine in 1711. So he was really on the up. And then he'd got a job called Teller of the Exchequer, which was basically a sort of quite a lucrative sinecure job where you were responsible for all the money which was paid into the Exchequer, and it had to sort of pass through your hands. And he had this position between 1711 and 14. Now, he'd already started to fall from grace a little bit after that, because when the Hanoverians came in, he was suspected of having Jacobite sympathies. And so he'd lost his job as the Teller of the Exchequer. And he'd also been for a time imprisoned in the Tower of London because of his Jacobite sympathies. But he was able to negotiate his release and went back to Brodsworth. And we think then that he spent quite a lot of time then in the period between sort of 1715 and 1720, sort of remodelling the house, laying out new pleasure gardens and woodland walks. So he's spending quite a lot of money on the estate. And in 1719, he became the Earl of Kinnewl when his father died. So he's really sort of increasing his wealth and status at this point. But then comes the South Sea bubble. He loses a lot of money. It's said that it brought him close to bankruptcy. And work at Brodsworth then comes to an abrupt halt. And he actually deserts his wife and children, flees to London, leaving them to fend for themselves at Brodsworth. And then he spends most of his time sort of drinking in London and basically feeling sorry for himself. And then in 1729, in an attempt to sort of redeem himself, he gets the ambassadorship of the Sublime Portes in Constantinople and disappears off to the Ottoman Empire. to be ambassador, but things don't quite work out there, and he gets recalled by the king in disgrace in 1736 because of his poor judgment and the fact he was still drinking too much, his fondness for drink. And all this time, his poor wife and family are surviving at Brodsworth with on only £700 a year rental income, which, and she's got 10 children, so it's quite a lot of people to try and keep comfortably on a very reduced income. So you sort of see this idea of the wife and children muddling through at Brodsworth on a very low income while he's soaking himself in London and then over in Constantinople. And he dies in 1758, and he's still not recovered his fortune or his reputation by then. So it's a real tale of decline and dissipation.
Yeah, and similar to the Rest Park situation as well, in a sense, that this terrible weight of debt was hanging over the people who were connected to the person who traded these shares. So
exactly. I mean, I think in his case, the threat of the debt would have been so great that he'd, you know, the disgrace of having this debt had been so great that he'd sort of absented himself from his estate. I mean, I think we'd probably look upon him slightly less charitably today, but for deserting his wife. But the impact of the losses must have been significant for him.
Was everyone who invested in the South Sea Company negatively affected?
Well, certainly in terms of people with the English heritage connections, not everyone. And if you turn to Henrietta Howard at Marble Hill House, well, she seems to have been lucky in that she had advice from the Earl of Islay, who was sort of almost her, sort of helping her to manage her finances. And he seems to have been a very canny investor in terms of the advice that he gave to her. The situation was that she had an unhappy marriage and her husband had been very abusive. And so both she and her husband had ended up joining the royal court in Hanover. This is the court of George I at the time there. And then when the court came back to London, when George I came to the throne in 1714, Henrietta and her husband had come back, and she was working at this time as a woman of the bedchamber for the Prince of Wales. So quite an important position within the royal court. And then later, when the Prince of Wales became king, she became mistress to him. But at the same time, she was looking for some independence, some financial independence. And so she'd invested some money that she had at the Earl of Islay's suggestion in some shares. And she'd bought shares in a company that Helen mentioned earlier, in the Mississippi Company, or the sort of French African Company. And she invested 5,000 livres, which is quite a lot of money, in buying some shares in the autumn of 1719. But it seems as if she was very lucky, because, I mean, as Helen mentioned, the stocks initially went up very quickly, and some people were making up to 130% profits, but then they crashed. But Henrietta seems to have got her shares out of the Mississippi Company just in time and invested them in the South Sea Company. So she moved her shares from the French company to the English company, the South Sea Company. And then again, she seems to have invested at just the right time. And she seems to have got out of the South Sea Company as well before the shares collapsed, because she's still on speaking terms with the Earl of Islay a year or so later. And in fact, he helps her with the acquisition of land for the building of Marble Hill. So it very much sounds as if she didn't lose a lot in the bubble. And then if we move the story forward a little bit to the period after the bubble, at this point, the king is releasing Henrietta from her royal duties as his mistress, and he gives her a financial settlement of up to £11,500 of stock, of which 70% of this is in the South Sea Company. But this is the South Sea Company post the crash. So this money is then used to invest in the building of Marble Hill House and the acquisition of land for the building of Marble Hill, with the advice coming in from Islay. And there is also another link to the bubble from this story, in that the land that Marble Hill is built on is purchased from a politician and merchant called Thomas Vernon, who had been very closely linked in with the South Sea Company. He was a director, and he had suffered significantly in terms of loss of reputation when the bubble happened. And it's thought that his financial losses meant that he had to sell some land, and that was the land that Marble Hill was then built on. So, you know, it was almost the unintended consequences of the crash, was that this land became available, and therefore Henrietta was able to build her house there in Twickenham. So, yeah, she seems to have, through either luck or judgment or whatever, has been able to come out of this rather well.
Yes, and in some respects, in a strange way, we can thank the South Sea Company for the fact that Marble Hill is there today for us to look at and walk around.
Exactly, yeah. The land wouldn't have been available for it to be built on. It was through the South Sea stocks that Henrietta had enough money to be able to buy the land and build the house, yes.
Presumably, after the crash, there was some sort of recovery in the price, and she did manage to make some money from her shareholding. But did she get out of that position eventually?
Well, yes. I mean, when she built the house, she had to sell the shares in order to realise the assets. But, I mean, this was a period in the mid-1720s, by which point, as Helen was saying, the price had begun to gradually go up again and the shares had recovered their value. But, I mean, she'd acquired those shares in 1722, which was post-crash, when they were probably at some of their lowest prices. So there were things that were on the up. So, yeah, she benefited two times round. She benefited first time round by selling her initial stocks before the price collapsed, and then buying additional shares at a time when they were low. So, yeah, she was the traditional canny investor.
Mm. So you've given us two there who were really down on their luck, and then the third, a lady, Henrietta Howard, who seemed to do okay. Were there examples of other great estates beyond those cared for by English Heritage that were affected, some important ones?
There are. I had a quick look through the archives to see if I could find any good examples, and I turned up a couple of really good examples of people who were badly affected. And it's interesting that these were mainly people who were extremely wealthy beforehand. So, for instance, if you look at James Bridges, the first Duke of Chandos, he invested a huge amount of his fortune, £200,000, in building a new house, Cannons, at Little Stanmore in Middlesex, between 1713 and 24, so over the period of the crash. But he's known to have lost a massive amount of money in the South Sea Bubble, and his finances and of his family never recovered after that. So a man who'd been vastly wealthy through holding lots of public offices, he's got this massive white elephant of a house that he can't afford. And when he dies in 1747, his son, Henry, has the house demolished and sells off all the contents. So you have this house only built in 1713 at vast expense, which only lasts 30, 40 years, less than that.
Mm.
And then another example is Thomas Coke, Earl of Leicester, and he's had plans to build a new house at Holcombe really from the early 1720s, but he has to delay the plans when he loses a suggested sum of £40,000 on South Sea stocks. And this means that rather than building his house quickly like he'd intended to, it takes him 30 years and it's still unfinished when he dies in 1759. So you get this idea that it's not completely ruining people, but it's meaning that their finances are so reduced that they're not able to carry on with some of the, you know, maybe impressive building projects that they had. And other people who lost money were like the Duke of Portland of Welbeck Abbey and our own Bolsover Castle. He lost quite a lot of money, as did Lady Mary Wortley Montagu. And interestingly, she'd taken advice to invest from the poet Alexander Pope. And I guess she probably should have gone to a proper broker rather than
a fortune
poet,
teller. But,
yes. So there are all number of people who seem to have lost money. As Helen was saying earlier, though, without the ledgers, we don't know the details of how many there were and how much they all lost, unless it's recorded in their family papers.
Yes, that's really interesting. I'd like to bring Helen back on that point, actually. For everyone who has invested their money, I'm presuming it had to have gone somewhere. We talked about some people profiting from this saga, but how widespread was the profit?
Well, in some ways, the government benefited hugely because they got rid of all their old IOUs that were so complicated to manage. So that was one benefit. You also had money going to people who had perhaps bought these shares quite early on, thinking there'd just be a regular payment from the government and not really expecting them to go up in value. People like Thomas Guy, who was a London bookseller and now more famous for Guy's Hospital, he made money on behalf of his hospital project because he sold out at the top of the market. And you get people of that sort who basically see that the shares are overvalued, but they don't tend to talk about it very much because there's a rhetoric in the political debate about the South Sea sufferers, the idea that some of those transactions will be cancelled and the people who made money would have to give it back. Now, that doesn't actually happen. Some of the people who swapped government IOUs for shares in the last phase, their transactions are altered ex post. But a lot of people just kept the money and didn't say much about it. So that's why it's very difficult to identify them.
You talked about the IOU situation kind of being solved. Did the government become solvent again?
The government benefited hugely because they'd been locked into high interest rate contracts, essentially, that were often very short term, or that they couldn't get out of without the debt holder's permission. So what they got is just paying a fat fee to the South Sea Company, and that benefited the government hugely. So it was a complete win for them, really. But of course, in political terms, they talked up the idea that there was fraud and scandal and that they were going to do something about this, and had a kind of show trials. But actually, the government came out very well.
Yes, I'd like to get into this sort of idea of fraud and market manipulation. I'll bring Andrew in as well if he wants to contribute. Was there an inquiry, and were there any laws passed to stop this sort of thing from happening again?
There was certainly an inquiry. There was something with a very sinister name called the Secret Committee. It didn't seem to be all that secret. A group of people who were politicians who were brought together to talk about what had happened and who tried to investigate as much as they could. But the cashier of the company, Robert Knight, had been allowed to escape with some of the books. And then he'd been allowed to get away once he was captured on the continent. The government made a lot of noise about getting him back, but then tacitly, behind the scenes, asked for him to be let go. So he just vanished off with these books. What was covered up by Robert Walpole, who became vilified as the Screen Master General, was that there'd been various bribes paid to important people, including one of the king's mistresses. So the people who were really dragged in front of the parliament were the directors of the company and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, John Aislaby, who was put in the Tower of London for a little bit as a kind of symbolic act. He wasn't really there for very long. But then the directors had their estates valued. They had a chunk of their estates confiscated. But then oddly, in many cases, some of that confiscation was actually then given back to them. So it was really about creating a political theatre, and some money was brought back in from various directors and from Aislaby.
So it doesn't really sound as though justice was really done. It sounded like a bit of an inside job and, you know, the government marking its own homework.
Very much so. I mean, when you look at some of the details of the relationships between some of the leading bankers of the day and some of the governors and directors of the company, you can sort of see that there's what we would probably call today of insider trading going on. You know, people who had a inside knowledge of how the company was doing and so were able to make their share trades at the right time. And that was never really picked up on in any of the scrutiny afterwards. People like Benjamin Stiles, for instance, he made a fortune out of the sale of stocks just before the peak, and was able to purchase a new estate and build a new house at a cost of £150,000 on the proceeds that he'd made. And he was able to get inside knowledge because his brother-in-law was one of the sub-governors of the company, one of the directors of the company. So he was able to presumably have a tip of when it looked like the things were about to unravel, and so could sell just in time. And so you can see how the corruption that was at the heart of government at this time, I mean, it was thought that most of the politicians in government at the time had some form of inside knowledge of what was going on, and quite a few of them made money out of it and had been making huge amounts of money just off bribery and corruption. I mean, people like Walpole himself was able to build an enormous country house in Norfolk, Houghton Hall, based on the money, which was way above the money he should officially have been getting from his government position. So you can see that really the government had no incentive to look in too much detail at the scandal, because they all had their snouts in the trough, as they say, already.
That's really terrible. I'm shaking my head here. I can't quite believe it. But let's talk about some of the law changes. Were there any of those?
In terms of the way in which the law could be changed, it couldn't be done very effectually. There's lots of discussion about doing something, but nothing really effective tends to get done at this time period, because they just didn't have the ability to check back through the records in quite the same way we have today. And they're not very clear about what they mean by stock jobbing. This is a pejorative term used. Does it mean trading in derivatives? They kept trying to ban derivatives trading, but that wasn't happening. It just wasn't really very effective, whatever they did try to do. But they did create something called the Bubble Act, which people often think has something to do with controlling companies, because it forced them to have a royal charter without which they could then function in the same way. But actually, the Bubble Act really just set up two insurance companies. So it's a bit of a red herring to think that that was really important. But I think economic historians downplay its importance in controlling the financial sector.
It sounds as though very much that, as Andrew said, everyone sort of had their finger in the pie, really. And there was no real solution to the entire saga because everyone would have been implicated. But today, of course, we have the Financial Conduct Authority. And before that, before the 2008 Great Recession, we had the Financial Services Authority. It kind of got rebranded. And the financial world is now heavily regulated. But what was the regulatory climate of trading in the 1700s? I'm guessing you're going to tell me there was none.
Well, there were attempts. They created licensed brokers, the idea being that you had to pay a fee and you couldn't trade on your own behalf. You'd just be an intermediary helping other people. But there was no real effective way of stopping unlicensed brokers, so the whole system grew like Topsy. If you're having share trading in coffee houses or in other places, it's quite difficult to regulate that. When you get a proper building, a stock exchange building with rules and regulations and brokers within that building, there is that body that controls those brokers. But even then, you have people who were not part of that system and still worked as intermediaries. There's not an awful lot of incentive to control share trading when you have so many other things that aren't under control, because there's no proper police force, for example. There's not a lot of control over a quite wide range of things. So share trading is just one of those things that an early modern state can't quite get a grip on.
What was the impact after all this had died down on the economy and politics of the time?
Very little effect long-term on the economy that we can see. There's been some thought that it might have affected the Irish economy a bit more because it was much smaller amount of capital in that economy, and therefore if you draw it out, that's problematic. But actually, a lot of the people that we've heard about seem to be moving large chunks of money from one big stately home to somebody else's big stately home, so you're still getting the same spending into the economy per se. There's a fear that somehow foreigners would be drawing out money and taking it abroad, but actually British-based investors were also investing abroad as well, so it probably evens out pretty easily, and we don't see much effect in the economy. Political ramifications seem to be much more important.
Tell us a bit more about the politics and the ramifications there.
Well, you have to remember that this is a brand new royal house. The Hanoverians have only been in situ for a handful of years. I mean, this is after the death of Queen Anne. The next Protestant heir is George the First, and he doesn't really have much to do with the country at all because Queen Anne didn't want a rival heir in situ. So he's come in from Hanover with all of his Hanoverian friends and hangers-on, and this is at odds with an existing Catholic line of the Stuarts who are still alive and living in France. It's not just dyed-in-the-wool Jacobites who might support the restoration of a Stuart monarchy, but people who felt, on the Protestant side as well, that God had chosen the Stuarts to be kings in England and that George I was only a de facto king. Now, if there had been a severe economic crash, you might have seen the Hanoverian regime fall at the first hurdle. And that's part of the reason why people like Robert Walpole had this cover-up, is to protect the new Protestant family, royal family. Because if France hadn't had a debilitating crash at the same time, the French could have invaded and put a Stuart on the throne as a kind of puppet French king.
From what you've been describing there then, Helen, it sounds as though there's still this really strong tussle between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism well into the 1700s, amidst the backdrop of this giant stock market crash. That's something that I didn't really anticipate when we were going to be talking about this today.
Well, there were attempts to have minor Jacobite uprisings or rebellions in 1715 and 1719, and they're much less famous than the 1745 one, which everyone's heard about. If you're coming into the South Sea period, you know that the Jacobite threat is there, and that is part of the reason why people might have tolerated a limited inquiry into the bubble.
Have there been any other crashes like the dot-com bubble or the subprime mortgage crisis, which are comparable to what happened with the South Sea Company 300 years ago?
Probably the dot-com bubble is the most similar, in the sense that a lot of people thought it was the end of the world, but actually a lot of viable dot-com companies came out of that. And if you invested sensibly and you had a diversified portfolio, you could ride out losses here or there. If you went mad and put all your money into some dot-com company that you hadn't really thought about in any detail, then you would be completely wiped out. But that could happen in any stock market. You could have people who invest in a very strange way. That's very different to the subprime mortgage crisis, which frankly dragged in people who had nothing to do with the stock market, because it had a huge effect on the real economy.
Absolutely. And we've been paying for it ever since. What lessons to both of you do you think that modern economists or investors can take away from the South Sea bubble story?
Well, what I would say was simply that you need to be a careful investor and you need to think about your investments. I mean, the problems, as Helen just said, with both the dot-com bubble and the South Sea was that you had effectively companies which were almost a mirage. The actual value of the company was far different than the value that its shares had risen to. And that was the same case with the dot-com bubble. These companies that actually had just a notional value, that they weren't really worth what people were investing in them. And then suddenly there's a realization and you get the crash. So basically diversify your investments. Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Would you agree with that, Helen? I mean, we shouldn't give a financial advice on a history podcast, but...
I'd say so. I mean, certainly people often don't diversify their portfolios. They become keen on certain shares, often for psychological reasons. You get people routinely holding on to shares in the company they work for, which is a clear example of not diversifying your portfolio, yet people do that. So one of the other things about the South Sea bubble is you see a lot of talk that goes nowhere, a lot of people being blamed and scapegoated because of who they are, not because of what they've done. And I think that's something you see going throughout history, that then there's a crash, you see a hunt for scapegoats.
I think it's also worth noting that we haven't really learnt much in the financial markets. Crash after crash, the people who are responsible for this often don't get punished. And is that something that has repeated over history, would you say?
Definitely, I think so. And there's certainly a push to deregulate. There's always this tension between, if we just got rid of regulation, then we'd make more money. So I think you do get problems where people make a huge amount of money and then they hide it in some way.
We're gradually improving, certainly in terms of regulation, but history does seem to repeat itself, and I think the common denominator is always human nature. What would you say about that, Andrew?
Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, in a sense, whenever you're investing in shares, it's a little bit of a gamble, isn't it? You know, the price can drop or it can go up, and you get carried along on the crest of a wave because things are going up, but it's difficult to know when to get off the ship and to sell up. That's always been the case, and that thrill of seeing money racking up as you're making money and then knowing when to pull out is not that different than, you know, the sort of gambler at the slot machine feeding money in. I think that human thrill of sort of getting something for nothing is always going to be there, isn't it?
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. To discover more about the history of the sites mentioned in this episode, go to the English Heritage website. Join us next week when we're back to discover the story of the great siege of Dover Castle in 1216.
Any medieval siege was a combination of trying to persuade those inside to give up, and if that didn't happen, then obviously to break in.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.